very generous. And this is, I'll be talking about the work that I've done in collaboration with Marcel Reginato. And another nice thing about this meeting for me is Marcel and I met by email in 2000 and wrote a couple of papers together, and we didn't meet till October 2001. Since then, we've written papers off and on over the years, but this is the second time we've actually met face to face. So that's a really nice part of this meeting for us. Alrighty. So the outline of my talk, I'll start with, in a sense, it's a bit of a historical outline. It's sort of what we've found out as we've gone along the way in our collaboration. And the sort of true fact that Lucien mentioned yesterday that we take from quantum mechanics as a motivation is that quantum mechanics doesn't just have inequalities for uncertainty relations, like the Heisenberg inequality. If you choose your measures of uncertainty carefully enough, you can get equalities relating uncertainties of position and momentum in some sense. And so that's a strong starting point to say, can you turn that around and perhaps derive quantum mechanics? However, that's not a true reconstruction in a sense. What we set out to do was to say, what is it about quantum mechanics that's non-classical? What's the core non-classical part that distinguishes it from classical mechanics? So although later on in the talk I'll be getting closer to the idea of actually deriving quantum theory without making a reference to classical mechanics, I'll be starting off there with, we'll actually be taking classical mechanics as a starting point. How do we have to modify, you can modify classical mechanics in various ways. I'm going to modify it using an exact uncertainty principle and take uncertainty as the core conceptual element in moving from classical to quantum mechanics. Then I've got an intermission, but it's an important intermission, so don't go away. Because we decided after carrying out this sort of procedure, we looked at the formalism we had, and we decided it was a very interesting formalism. It assumes certain things about the descriptions of physical systems. It's weaker than assuming, say, C-star algebras, but it's stronger than certain other approaches. But it just turns out to be very interesting. So I'll talk a little bit about what the idea behind ensembles on configuration space are for describing a generic physical system, and then have a look at a couple of applications where, rather than trying to derive quantum mechanics, can one go beyond quantum mechanics using this formalism in some consistent way? There's various no-go theorems saying you can't do this and you can't do this. We can do this. We're not sure about this. that's ongoing work at the moment that we've been doing this year. And I've added in a very squash slide after Philip said, talk about open problems and so on. So I'll mention some of that at the end. All right, so this is the starting point. If you've got quantum mechanics, it's a fact that you've got these exact uncertainty relations if you go about it the right way. So for simplicity, I'll just consider a particle moving in one dimension, normal sort of bone decomposition of the wave function. And I'll assume we know the wave function, and we can define this quantity, therefore. And this is quite a familiar quantity that appears in the Bohmian interpretation of quantum mechanics, that appears in the continuity equation. It's a weak value of the momentum for that state, conditioned on a position measurement. And you can also show that if you want to say, what's the best estimate I can make of the momentum of the system, given I knew the state I started with, I knew psi, and I've made a measurement of position, what's the best estimate of momentum I can make? It turns out this is the best estimate under a fairly natural measure, estimation measure. So I'm going to call that the classical component of the momentum for a quantum system. There's a number of reasons for doing so. Now I can decompose my momentum operator, at least when acting on that state, into this plus whatever's left over. So naturally I'll call that the non-classical component of the momentum. Notice it's a sort of state-dependent operator. I should have a little superscript psi perhaps on those, but it doesn't matter. I'm only going to evaluate these operators for this state. Okay. And you might hope that this non-classical part then somehow tells us what it is that's non-classical about quantum mechanics, or at least what's non-classical about the Schrodinger equation. And in a sense it does. You get these exact uncertainty relations related to the uncertainty of that quantity. And a couple of interesting properties. Obviously, if you take the average of the momentum, I think I've used up the laser pointer already, the average of this will be the average of this plus the average of this. The average is decomposed, but it turns out they also decompose in quadrature, and the uncertainties decompose of these quantities. And so in particular, I could say, well, there's a non-classical momentum uncertainty. Seems like an interesting quantity. What sort of uncertainty relations does that satisfy? Well, before I get to that, we just take a... As I said, you have to choose your measures of uncertainty a little carefully. But here's one measure of uncertainty. It's a bit unusual. It's based on the Fisher information. And so it's suitable to call it the Fisher length. The Fisher information Katicha talked about, Ariel Katicha talked about yesterday. It does depend on the derivative of P, but in quantum mechanics, if you don't have a smooth probability density, you generally have infinite energy anyway. This thing's always finite. It does vanish if you have a discontinuous P. So it does give you a suitable measure of spread of the wave function for smooth functions. And for Gaussians, it's equal to the normal root mean square variance. So this comes from Fisher information. This comes from quantum mechanics. If you put them together, for any pure state, doesn't matter what it was, the Fisher length times the root mean square uncertainty of this non-classical part of the momentum is equal to h bar on 2. And so that's what we can call an exact uncertainty relation. And I've just got a little bit down the bottom. Obviously, delta p is greater than delta p non-classical because, well, that's obvious. Also, there's from classical statistics, there's an inequality called the Kramer-Rao inequality, which basically says your Fisher length's always less than the or equal to the root mean square uncertainty. It's equal in the case of Gaussians. So from this, you can go immediately to the usual Heisenberg uncertainty relation. All right. So the question then that came up, in fact, Marcel asked the question, can you go the other way? You've got this pretty strong looking relation. Could you somehow use that to try and understand what it is that's non-classical about quantum mechanics? Start with classical mechanics in a suitable form. Add some non-classical momentum, a non-classical component to the classical momentum, and end up with something that looks like quantum mechanics. And so this extra uncertainty given by this non-classical momentum will be the core feature. And it turns out you can do it. And that's what I'll talk about now for the next few minutes. You've got to decide how you're going to describe a classical system. And because we want to get quantum mechanics, we just take the sort of loose motivation that nature is statistical, even classical mechanics. Sure, you could have point positions and trajectories, but more generally, you might know everything about it. So you can have a probability distribution over the possible positions of the system. And in classical mechanics, you've got a Hamilton-Jacobi formalism. This is a Hamilton-Jacobi function S. And these two equations will then describe the classical motion on the motion on for a classical configuration space, an ensemble on configuration space. If you then define this functional, the classical Hamiltonian HC, in this way, and you can see it just looks like the average of the usual classical energy where you identify this with the momentum as you do in the Hamilton-Jacobi approach. What's interesting about it is that these equations can be rewritten in a canonical form. And Bohm sort of just notes this as an aside in his paper on his interpretation, the Boley-Bohm interpretation, but this is somewhat unrelated to it. So you can write the equations in this nice canonical way. That's the classical starting point we take. And now we, oops, apologize. Where are we going? Ah, here we go. No, I'm lost. Ah, good, sorry. So we just assume now that there's a disconnect between the classical momentum and whatever we mean by, you know, the result of a momentum measurement. We're adding some sort of non-classical fluctuation. The fluctuation may be different from point to point. I don't care about having a model for the fluctuation. If you're trying to have a classical model for it, it's going to be non-local. So why bother? I tend to think of it more as more useful that if you have this equation holding, you can integrate and get trajectories for a classical system. Once you bring in some sort of non-classical fluctuation, you get a disconnect, and suddenly you don't have trajectories anymore. You've got something a little different. Here, because I couldn't use a bar in my word processing program, this just means the expectation of the fluctuation at point X of configuration space. So we assume the fluctuation vanishes on average at each point. So then we have a look at what happens to the average energy of our ensemble when we've got these extra fluctuations. That's pretty simple, bung that in, work out the average energy, and we get an extra contribution to the kinetic energy from these fluctuations. And what we'd like to do is say, we'd like this to somehow depend on P and S, so we can identify this as a new ensemble Hamiltonian. And so the idea now is, but the core idea of adding the fluctuations, we'd then like to place some restrictions on those and hopefully end up with a quantum Hamiltonian for these quantities P and S, where the equations of motion will then be equivalent to the Schrodinger equation. So we make just three assumptions. One is that if you've got two independent systems, the probability distribution, say two particles, factorizes. We'd like each component of the fluctuation for each of the two particles to be statistically uncorrelated. We'd also like, we assume anyway, and that's a pretty reasonable assumption. I think this one's probably pretty reasonable too, which is saying if we rescale our position coordinates in some linear way, then we expect the momentum, you know, canonical transformation, if we scale this, if we scale position by x over lambda, p will go to p times lambda, and so we'll need f to go to f times lambda. And actually, you can, this is a condition on a covariance matrix. You can rewrite this as a condition on how the covariance matrix transforms. And then the sort of the big assumption, motivated by the fact that exact uncertainty relations, is that the average, the root mean square fluctuation, more generally the covariance matrix of the fluctuations, I should say, especially when you go to fields, only depends on where you are and what's happening with the probability density at that point. In other words, position's uncertain, it's described by a probability distribution. Momentum is uncertain from the traditional classical momentum, but by how much? By an amount that depends only on the probability distribution, effectively, at that point. Okay. So that's the exact... note, we're not assuming that there's a Fisher information form or anything like that, just that it's a function of those quantities. With those assumptions, you can derive that this kinetic energy term, more generally the form of the covariance matrix of the fluctuations, but just simplified here by looking at the grad F squared, the free particle type kinetic term, has this form, plus higher order derivatives in P. So you need strictly some argument to knock out higher order derivative terms, or you can just argue, well, simplicity is sort of the simplest case. And it turns out that C is a positive universal constant due to the scaling and the independence assumptions. C has the same value for all systems, and it's positive, naturally, because the covariance matrix in general must be positive, in fact. So this becomes the new form of our Hamiltonian, the quantum Hamiltonian, we call it. And the equations, we then look, what are the equations of motion that we've got? They'll be given by that. You can work them out. And not surprisingly, remember this is a positive constant. It's got the right units of action. You just define h bar in that way. You define psi in this way. And you can even argue, why should we even suddenly define a wave function psi, a complex wave function? Because we've got a canonical structure, p and s are canonically conjugate variables, we can we can think about making canonical transformations from the fields p and s to any other arbitrary field, say psi and chi. And you can ask, is there a canonical transformation such that the transformation to the two new fields, their equations decouple. They decouple the equations. And there is, but you have to actually transform to complex fields, and those two fields turn out to be psi and psi star. So you can even make an argument for why you rewrite the equations of motion in the quantum form. And when you do that, you end up with the Schrodinger equation. Okay. The Schrodinger equation is pretty good. We've got the right probability density. It's mod psi squared, just from the way it's defined. And we've got the Schrodinger equation. In a sense, that's enough to derive most of quantum mechanics, but we can say a little bit more. When we want to think what observables are, we just go the same way as we do from the classical viewpoint. Observables are generators of the motion, generators of canonical transformations, generators of infinitesimal canonical transformations. So you could say, well, what's the generator of translations in this formalism? That'll be whatever functional of P and S sends P to X, P of X minus epsilon, S to S of X minus epsilon for small epsilon to first order. And you can work out what it is, and that's what it is. And it's quite interesting. It looks like, classically, the average momentum. And that's also the quantum formula for the average momentum. And you can define a position observable. It turns out all the observables, it turns out, can be interpreted as expectation values, if you like. If we look at, we define the so-called ensemble position observable, it's the average position of the particle. We've got a Poisson bracket. Remember, these are functions of P and S. P and S satisfy a Poisson bracket relation, a field one. So I can have a look at the components of these, and I find that you get this Poisson bracket relationship, which is nice. So in some sense, they're canonically conjugate at the higher level. And when you work out, well, okay, these are interesting observables. What do they look like written in terms of psi? They look like psi, star, operator, psi, integrate. And when you work out angular momentum, what's the generator of rotations? You find, well, it's pretty nice. It's just P of X cross grad S, or more generalized to higher dimensions. And so you and you find that also looks like psi, star. It's a bilinear form in psi. And so, and that already gives us the main observables that we need to make quantum predictions. We've got angular momentum, we've got momentum, we've got position. We can then construct the Galilean boost in the normal way. We've got a Hamiltonian. What we don't really have or looked at too hard in this approach was, we can throw our hands in the air and do something which is actually what's normally done in quantum mechanics anyway, and say, well, any bilinear form is an observable, as long as it conserves probability. And so I'm not going to try and motivate why one would do that here. We're going to get to finite dimensional systems. But the interesting thing is, when you calculate the Poisson bracket for such an operator, for such an observable, the expectation value of an operator, it's equal to the quantum commutator of the operators divided by IH bar. All right. And so, in other words, this is just to point out that the Poisson bracket algebra is isomorphic to the quantum commutator algebra. You find them in that way. All right, so that's, in a sense, the first part of the talk. Can we distinguish the non-classical features of quantum mechanics from classical mechanics using uncertainty? Well, yes, we can. And what's interesting is we assume there's fluctuations in the momentum, and we assume some simple properties, although admittedly the exact uncertainty property, the magnitude of the fluctuations only depends on uncertainty in probability, is a fairly strong assumption. Well, we can do it. What do I want to say here? Oh, yes, you can generalize this approach straightforwardly as long as your classical Hamiltonian is quadratic in the momentum or for fields in the momentum density. And that seems like a limitation until you start looking at all the real physical fields out there, and they're all like that at heart. And so this approach is lean and mean in that sense. You can only do quadratic Hamiltonians in the momentum density, but that's all we need to do. The other way in which it's lean and mean is that if you had, say, a position-dependent mass, or more generally a kinetic term that looked like, say, an inertia tensor times Pi times Pj for your classical Hamiltonian, when you follow this approach by adding fluctuations, you get a unique operator ordering comes out. We call it the sandwich ordering. And so that's interesting because possibly with you could make predictions. When you've got semiconductor systems, electrons and holes can move in those semiconductors in a way that looks as though they have a position-dependent mass, depending on the semiconductor structure. And so I don't think anyone's done experiments yet saying, you know, what is the operator ordering you should use to get the right predictions out for the energy spectrum, for example. I'm concentrating mostly on pluses. Here's another plus, which we realized after a while. This way of thinking about physical systems is actually, that this is based on, is actually quite interesting. That's what I'll be spending most of the rest of the talk on. But there's still a couple of minuses in what I've done here. Finite Hilbert spaces, we need some sort of special pleading. We can look at, oh, well, what's the angular momentum of a particle? We can get the sort of angular momentum operator. We can say, oh, yeah, we might restrict the angular momentum operator to a subspace of psi, but we're not really deriving our finite Hilbert space theory. But I'll talk more about that later on. So it's interesting, this approach, continuous systems are easy. Finite systems, you know, they're a bit harder. But that's only in this exact uncertainty approach. When I talk about the more general way, not really a problem. The other thing that we've done here, which is unlike what most people are doing at this workshop, we're not really trying to get quantum mechanics ab initio. We're really saying, let's take a classical starting point and say, what's the non-classical thing that we have to add? Some people say, oh, superposition is the main thing. Or it's non-commuting C-star algebra. Or it's non-distributive quantum logic. Here it's the idea of adding non-classical momentum fluctuations. All right. Yep.
You mentioned that the Hamiltonians were restricted to be quadratic.
So this adding the fluctuations to work, yes.
So when you say that's what we have in nature, you're thinking rather than use a Coulomb potential, you're going to couple, say, a charge to a field through an A-dot coupling, and everything's going to be quadratic in that sense.
Oh, yeah, that's fine too. So you can have linear terms and quadratic terms.
Yes. Yeah. So my question is, have you done this for fields?
Yes.
So, okay, it all works out.
Marcel will be talking. There's one field which doesn't work. That's if you second quantize the Schrodinger field. You get, that's not linear in the momentum density. But if you instead quantize the Klein-Gordon field and say, well, the Schrodinger field equation is a it's just a limit, particular limit of it. That's okay then, because the Klein-Gordon equation, that field, the momentum density of the field, the Hamiltonian is quadratic in that momentum density. So in that sense, for true physical fields, that's fine. Works for gravity too. Marcel will be talking about how it goes through for the field case. He'll look at the electromagnetic field and the gravitational field. Yeah. So yes. Yeah, so strictly speaking, yeah, a lot of, in solid state, you like to quantize the Schrodinger field. And this approach won't go through for it per se, but if you derive the Schrodinger field as a low energy approximation of the Klein-Gordon field, then everything's fine. Very fine. All right. Any other questions? Okay. All right. So the intermission is really saying, let's take a step back, and what were we using to get that result that might be more generally useful or interesting? And it's this notion of saying, let's describe physical systems by ensembles on configuration space and see what we can get away with. And so there's three main ingredients. We assume when you make a measurement, there's a set of possible outcomes. That's a configuration space. If you make a different set of measurement outcomes, there's going to be a different configuration space. But we can take one to start with, and we expect we're going to be able to transform to a different configuration space if we do a different measurement. And then we say, nature's uncertain. I don't know how Bayesian that might be. I don't want to get into that. But we'll say, we have to describe physical systems by ensembles in general. We can't get away with assuming they've got definite configurations. That's another resonance with Ariel Kasich's talk, I guess. And the space of outcomes, it might be discrete, in which case you have a probability distribution Pj. It might be continuous. There might be a mixture of discrete and classical outcomes. and we don't mind. And then the sort of big assumption, but it's reasonably natural, is P, it's our fundamental quantity describing our system, the ensemble. How does it evolve? We assume it's specified by an action principle. And a lot of people would be happy with that idea, but it actually gives you a lot of structure, so I guess it's a big assumption. But then that lets us do some interesting things. But as soon as we say that, we can say, we've got an action principle. That's terrific. We can write down a Lagrangian, maybe, assume there's a Lagrangian. We can assume there's Hamilton-Jacobi formalism. Well, we take the Hamiltonian form as the cleanest, because it says, if we've got P and a action principle given by a Hamiltonian, that gives us why there's a second quantity S to be interested in. It's got to be canonical conjugate to P. There's got to be some function or functional of P and S. And because they're canonically conjugate, we can define Poisson brackets. And these Poisson brackets, of course, they give you all your other observables, all the types of motions you can have. Okay. And then specifying such a theory, then you specify a starting configuration space, and you might specify your Hamiltonian. Your Hamiltonian is just going to be one of a set of possible generators that you identify as reasonable physical set of generators for this system. So that's what I mean by the suitable functions of P and S. And you expect them to be closed under the Poisson bracket. But otherwise, you've got a lot of freedom. And this is where you can start bringing in axioms to say, I've got a discrete configuration space with n possible outcomes, and my generators form a representation of SO2 or whatever. What one needs to do is keep two things in mind. Whenever we have a canonical transformation of P and S, P's got to map to a probability distribution. That's the basic idea, that P is a probability distribution. So that places restrictions on allowable generators of the motion, which can be written this way. This preserves positivity of P. And this idea that all physical generators are invariant under the addition of a constant of S to the components, that's the components of S, preserves normalization. And this tells you basically that your generators for the discrete case can only depend on differences of S values. In the continuous case, if you want a local theory, things can only depend on derivatives of S, like in that Jacobi. Okay. All right. So that's the starting point. We should just do a check and that things fit into this formalism that we're interested in. Quantum mechanics, choose a complete basis set, and it doesn't matter if it's a POVM or a projection valued set of states, as long as they sum to the identity, as long as they're complete. So in that sense, we can deal with POVMs, I suppose. Define P and S for a given pure state, it's pure states only, in this way. So for a given quantum state psi, this defines a function P of A and S of A. Define your generators to be the expectation values of emission matrices or operators. Take them as the physical generators, and when you look at what the Poisson brackets between two such things are, we've already seen it before for the case of position representation, it's given by that. Can we do classical mechanics? Yes, and it's a bit surprising to me. We can do classical phase space mechanics via, in a sense, ensembles on configuration space, which still gives me a surprise. So we suppose we've got a classical particle or system of particles indexed by x. And for any phase space function, fxp, define our generator in this way. And just note it looks like an average over the configuration space. So we're just replacing classical momentum by grad S seems reasonable. And the interesting thing you find is you work out the Poisson brackets, and down here is the normal phase space Poisson brackets between the two functions, F and G. I've used the same notation previously. So that's nice. We get we get the right algebras, if you like, for classical and quantum observables when you define them in this way. To get to mixed quantum states, density operators, you have to consider mixtures of ensembles. To get to all possible phase space distributions, you have to consider mixtures of these ensembles. So mixtures of PS pairs, if you like, but you can get everything. And you can define thermodynamics in such a way that you get quantum thermodynamics, you get the right answer, and you get classical thermodynamics for the classical case. What we haven't tried to do yet is to get a mixed quantum classical thermodynamic example, but I'll talk a bit more about that later. All righty, is that okay? I think that gives an idea of what's in the formalism. What can we get out of the formalism? Well, we've got two simple ideas, probability distribution on configuration, space of measurement outcomes is what defines a system, and it evolves according to an action principle. And it's nice that because you've got probability distributions from the start, rather than, say, abstract operators or abstract propositions, it's sort of easy to think about when you try and make, say, changes to the structure of quantum mechanics itself or to other theories. You know what, we've got a good feeling for what how probability distribution should behave to be physical. And it lets you ask questions. For example, it's well known, it's interesting in quantum mechanics that if you want to generate unitary transformations, you use Hermitian operators. And interestingly enough, you take a bilinear form of that same Hermitian operator, it gives you an expectation value. So the same operator does two physically quite distinct things. And so we don't have to assume this in this formalism, although in all the cases we've looked at, it seems natural, but it allows you to step outside that box a little. Although we've got a Poisson algebra, we don't have a product algebra for our observables necessarily assumed within the formalism. So the formalism's immediately weaker than C star algebras, for example. Again, stepping outside the box, why assume superselection rules, a linear constraint? We normally do, and in the direct formalism we do, because we know the wave function's what's important, everything has to be linear, so we'll jolly well take a linear constraint on our wave function. But if you've got a canonical formalism, you can take any canonical, there's a general theory of canonical constraints, and it certainly doesn't have to be linear with respect to psi. And it's interesting, you write down superselection rules for classicality and other things that are different from the usual one. And I've written the way of deconstructing quantum theory, because you're really having a look at, because you've got, it's the same with any broader formalism, of course, you can start picking quantum mechanics apart and saying, oh, some things do the work of two things, or there's hidden assumptions coming in that everything has to be linear. Why is that? Can we get away by not assuming that? Okay. Oh, and I've got the box. Yes, and what I'm going to finish up with this talk is how we can go beyond quantum mechanics. This is the end beyond part. Can we couple classical system to a quantum system in a consistent manner? There's various no-go theorems say no, you can't. Can we get a local nonlinear form of quantum mechanics? There's various no-go theorems saying no, you can't. We can get around these no-go theorems. We're not sure about this, it's work in process. At this stage I'm a little pessimistic, Marcel's a little optimistic, but I'll talk more about that in a minute. So I guess what we've been interested in doing with our formalism, we should maybe go back and try and reconstruct the Schrodinger equation from scratch, but we're sort of interested in going outside the box and seeing how we can modify quantum mechanics and get something a bit different. All righty. So, how are we going for time? All right. So why would we be interested in interactions between classical and quantum systems? Here I've just got two particles attached by a spring, one's classical, one's quantum. But it's a bit of a challenge. Bohr, for example, said, well, it's unanalyzable measurement. You've just got classical apparatus and the quantum thing. We can't talk about the interaction between them, hands off. So maybe that's not the case. Also, when we do equations, when you were talking about coupling for an electromagnetic field, say an unquantized field, replace P by P minus PA, you don't assume that anything happens to the field. You know, there's no back reaction on the field. So, you know, that's an approximation that one makes. Often in molecular calculations in quantum chemistry, you assume the nuclei are classical and the electrons are doing all the quantum whizzing about. But the equations you get, say, tend to be nonlinear and non-local at some level. And also, it would be interesting to have a consistent treatment if possible. Where you take space-time to be classical, we normally do, matter to be quantum, but where there can be a back reaction of the quantum matter on the classical space-time that goes beyond a simple mean field approach, which again is a non-linear approach, and there's problems. Okay, well the problem is, we're not meant to be able to do it. Lots of people have tried, and then people have shown, well, no, probability has been conserved, or probability has become negative, you don't have the correct classical limit when you take h bar goes to zero for the quantum case, you don't have any back reaction on the classical system from the quantum system, which means, say, you can't do measurement, for example, if you don't have this, because if the quantum system doesn't make the classical system do something interesting, you're in trouble. Or sometimes Sudarshan was able to get a case where he had a consistent approach to coupling them, but he could only describe certain interactions consistently. He couldn't describe the Stern-Gerlach interaction. And there's several interesting no-go theorems. Daniel Turner, who was here, I believe, earlier at Macquarie Uni now, he wrote quite took a polemic approach, I guess. So the standard paradigm of quantum systems measured by classical apparatus, that's untenable. And you can't, if you've got quantum matter, you've got to have a quantum space-time to get a consistent coupling. So he wrote an EP on that, based on a particular no-go theorem that he developed with Asher Perrin. But here's another guy who, Salcedo, from Spain, who did, although he proved some very strong no-go theorems, he said, oh, well, we are actually making some assumptions. Maybe we can go beyond those assumptions. And of course, as soon as you've got a new way for thinking about physical systems, you can have a look at, oh, are those assumptions natural in this framework that I've got? So are the assumptions of all these no-go theorems natural in the framework of configuration ensembles? No, they're not, because they essentially assume there's a certain product structure obeying certain rules. Say a bit like a C-star algebra, why should we assume we can multiply a Hermitian operator A by a Hermitian operator B? They're non-commuting, what's that product mean? It doesn't mean anything physically. Jordan algebra, that's all right, no problem there. But some of the assumptions in the no-go theorems don't really relate to anything going on physically. All right. So yes, we can get around it. There's a very natural way to couple quantum and classical systems. We've done things like the two oscillators that are coupled and looked at sort of this hybrid coherent states for them. We'd like to do hybrid thermodynamics. We haven't done that. Measurements where we assume we've got a classical pointer coupled to a classical system. We can analyze that, and I'll do that on the next page for a special case. And you can even derive for two particles that just have position coordinates, xc and xq, if you couple them by a potential in this way, turns out you get a form of Ehrenfest theorems hold. I've only written it for the classical components, but there's a similar one for the momentum components. And this actually, Dan Turner's paper was showing that you can't get this. He said it's a really important benchmark to have, but you can't do it. Well, you can do it. All right, so I'm going to just look at a momentum example in the next slide. Just an overview, just to give you an indication of what it looks like. And Marcel will look at the case of extending semi-classical gravity to the case where you have classical space-time and quantum matter interacting with it in a consistent way. So how do we measure spin? So I look at a very simple case. I've got a 1D particle. And it's classical, it's got a mass m and a position x, and I've got a spin half particle that can just take two values when you measure it, and I've got to choose a starting configuration space. I'll choose one, I'll choose a fiducial basis, if you like, that's the z direction. Okay, I'm interested in, I want to make a measurement of spin in that direction, and that's why it's good to choose that. Turns out I can do it in any system, of course, any basis. All right, so, and I look at the analogous case to, say, the quantum and the classical case where you just have a momentum coupling to the variable you want to measure, but I want to do it for the hybrid case. What does my, so I have to choose, I've ignored any self-Hamiltonian for the spin half. You can put one in, it doesn't really matter. I've written explicitly the spin, the classical particle Hamiltonian, and I've added to that a term that is that represents this sort of interaction. Remember, alpha equals plus or minus one, and so I've got some derivatives. And this, when you look at it, if you try and look at what happens in the quantum case, this is exactly the same form as you get in the quantum case anyway. So, in other words, in this formalism, it turns out to be no harder, in essence, to describe measurements via momentum couplings in this hybrid theory, say, coupling your quantum system to a classical apparatus, than it is to when you couple your quantum system to a quantum apparatus. Okay. So we do the same analysis, similar that we normally do in the quantum case. We'll assume that this term's large over a short time, and the integral over that little time period is given by a constant k. So we can ignore what's happening to this part of the motion for simplicity. We can write down, well, what are the equations of motion then? We can solve them. It's not hard. Remember, the equations of motion are just del p del t equals del h del s and so on. They're just the Hamiltonian equations of motion. And we just find that our probability distribution, if it spins up, the system's displaced to the right, the classical particle or the pointer. If it spins minus, it's displaced to the left. Same thing happens with the phase, if you like, or this conjugate quantity, but we can't measure that. This is what we're going to measure, of course. If we assume our initial systems were initially independent, we have a classical distribution for our pointer beforehand, and a probability of being up or down for our spin half system, then when you integrate, or sum over the two possibilities, up or down, and look at your distribution, you can see that this amount of the time you've got your pointer displaced by k, and with this probability your pointer is displaced by minus k. I guess that's an easy way to see what's happening. You can also, it turns out, define what the quantum density operator is conditioned on the classical result, on the classical pointer position, and you find that essentially it becomes diagonal, this conditional density operator. Okay, yeah, so and then you assume you can measure the pointer by some magical way, have it, immediate access to classical information, no problem there, and you find that the position of the pointer is correlated with the spin of the particle. All right, so that's just a bit of an overview, something where we can go beyond quantum mechanics in this formalism, and it's a bit interesting, at least. Right, and this is something that we've started on just recently, and that's trying to modify quantum mechanics to be nonlinear. And it's interesting, one of the stimulations is, hey, there's no good theorem saying this can't be done, so it's a challenge for this formalism. Why can't it be done? This formalism will give some insight into why you can't do it, or even better, say, oh, hang on, yes, you can get around the no-go theorem. So it's interesting from that point of view. Whether it relates, say, to solving problems of renormalization in gravity or anything like that, having a nonlinear modification, some of the other traditional assertions or interests, I can't think. Well, one of them is just, we really like quantum mechanics. It's nice and experimentally testable, of course, and it keeps giving us back quantum mechanics. But it'd be nice to have even a broader class of consistent theories, including nonlinear equations. It gives us something else to test, gives the experimentalists some more to do. So that's good. But Steven Weinberg had a beautiful paper where he tried doing it, but then it was immediately shown to be non-local. Gee, I've got deterministic evolution, but I can set up so what happens over here affects what happens over here. So that wasn't any good. Obviously, he tried a bit more, but then he gave up. And I don't know that he's tried again since. And Nicholas Giesen, yeah, this is very relevant to him, because they're all non-local. He was one of the people who proved Weinberg's model was non-local. All right. But again, no-go theorems are as strong as their weakest assumption. That came out different. Okay, so one interesting thing about the no-go theorems, a possible weakness, is they say, well, this is very observable. Say for a spin-half system, all the no-go theorems look at spin-half systems in similar states, for example. They say, well, we'll assume we've got all the same quantum observables we can measure. We can measure spin in any direction for a for a two-level system, a spin-half system. And then we'll assume there's another generator of the motion taken from nowhere that gives us a non-linear transformation of the wave function. And we'll just try and squeeze that in there with all those different rotation generators and hope everything will work. And it doesn't. So it's a bit like you update some software on your computer, download a new printer driver, but you don't connect the new printer, then maybe things won't work. So that gave us some hope that maybe what we want to do is actually say, well, spin-half system, the only evidence for any generators of the motion, or at least if you interpret them as observables, is you can just measure spin in any direction. So let's just change all those observables in some way, not try and add another observable, just tweak everything, deform everything a bit in some way. And maybe we can get around the no-go theorems, or maybe we'll find a stronger no-go theorem. So here I'll talk about the system we've been looking at mainly. And that's a row bit or a rotational bit. And really we want to say, so we think of a row bit as you've got a set of two valued observables or generators of the motion. The values might be plus or minus h bar on 2, why not? If you want to deform quantum mechanics a little bit, that seems reasonable. So each row bit will have a configuration space of up or down for a given direction, initial direction. And we want our generators, if we're going to identify them with observables, to have this Poisson bracket structure. It's got to be SO3. And because that's what we mean by rotations in 3-space. And I've just written out here, just reminding you that this thing's well known. These are functions of P and S, and that's how you define the Poisson bracket. And of course, you need to preserve the positivity of P and its normalization. These have to satisfy those two fundamental constraints I mentioned earlier. So we'll call such a thing a row bit or a rotational bit. And we really want our rotational bits to be local. I sort of said, are all local rotational bits qubits? And that's this question here. Can we go beyond quantum mechanics? Well, once we impose locality, are we fixed to standard quantum mechanics? And this is a good question, I think. It doesn't matter if I'm a bit pessimistic and Marcel's a bit optimistic. We'll keep working on it. Because perhaps it's not. And if so, we've got ourselves a reconstruction, at least, for two qubits. If they're to be two row bits, if they're to be local in our formalism, have to be qubits, essentially. The other possible answer is, hey, yeah, we can get something different from quantum mechanics, something that's local and non-linear. So it's certainly a question worth asking. As I say, we're not right at the answer. I just wanted to mention about how stepping away from the box by adopting a new formalism can help in understanding physical concepts. We've got the rough idea of locality as what I do over here doesn't affect the statistics over there. And so we've actually got to check a few things. We've got to check if we generate motion on one row bit, we rotate it, shouldn't affect any statistics on the other row bit, no matter what we measure. So that's an evolution locality. And also, if we make a measurement on one row bit, that shouldn't affect what the statistics of the other row bit. That's the no singling type of locality. Well, they're both no singling, of course, different aspects. And there's sort of another thing that we came up with, because you know, we looked at these and got some things that worked, and then we realized, really, there's another implicit idea in locality. If two things are non-interacting, they shouldn't be able to develop any correlations between them that they didn't have before. Because you could imagine developing correlations and yet the marginal statistics staying the same. So we need an idea of independent row bits. And so we found that was a problem. And where a lot of the models fail, most of the no-go theorems say, well, you can't even do this. Okay. But in down formalism, it's actually pretty easy to satisfy this. It's pretty easy to define independence. The probability distributions factorize and stay factorized. This is a bit harder because we want to be as general as possible. We don't want to make implicit assumptions about what collapse is. We don't. It's very easy to use Bayes' theorem to say we know what must happen to the probability distribution when we make a measurement on one of the systems. We know how to update that. But in a sense, you've got to make some assumption about updating the conjugate quantity S as well. And so this restriction is a little tricky, and that's what's causing us a bit of a headache at the moment. But anyway, and here I'm just pointing out What are we looking for? We're looking for a distribution on a bigger configuration space. Now, did I write it down? Oh, yeah. So now this describes probabilities of spin-up for each of the robids. So we've got a four-dimensional configuration. We've got an eight-dimensional phase space, essentially. And we want to find a set of functions of these quantities that obey SO3 plus SO3, the Lie algebra relations. And that's not too hard. We've been able to characterize all those. And yeah, this just indicates, well, we're not quite there. In fact, we've got fairly convincing arguments. It's very easy to make reasonable assumptions that end up saying you can't do it. There's a very obvious sort of collapse model to try, motivated by quantum mechanics. We have to change this. It turns out we have to tweak the standard quantum collapse model if we want to hope for the nonlinear things, but we don't know whether we can do that yet. All right. So this, sorry it's so crowded, I just sort of quickly prepared a page when Philip said it's, we want to talk about future work and so on. So this is something that's ongoing. This is something where Marcel's recently got a new result, hybrid gravity on MIDI superspace, not just MIDI superspace. I'm really interested in this problem, where you say Coulomb scattering. If you do it for a classical system or a quantum system, you get the same scattering cross-section, the Rutherford formula. It's quite interesting. But it's interesting, although you can show that the hybrid formalism satisfies between a classical and a quantum particle scattering off each other with an inverse square potential, satisfies overall Galilean invariance, the center of mass and relative motions don't decouple in the hybrid formalism. And you can already see that when you look at coherent states of a classical and quantum particle decoupled by a spring. It's quite interesting. But this is a mathematical thing that we're interested in. A lot of theories we've looked at satisfy this homogeneity property. And there's sort of collapse type arguments for why it's a good property. But it's really, you know, if you replace P, it shouldn't matter how you normalize P. Normalize it to anything. If this is an expectation value, it should then scale appropriately. But the interesting thing is if this property holds, we can define a weak value for any configuration ensemble system by this. Which turns out to reduce to the usual quantum, the quantum weak value. And so that's interesting just formally. It would also be interesting if we could also connect that with a weak value that you get from some sort of weak measurement interaction as well, and try to do that. And then this is more some connections. So this might be a bit vague and unclear, because my mind was vague and unclear. So I was thinking, you know, well, we've got Lucian's. In general, we've got convex structure approaches that people are interested in. And certainly, if we fix our discrete configuration space with n possible outcomes, when we do a canonical transformation, we'll still end up with a probability distribution with n possible outcomes. We're going to have a fixed constant. If we have two particles that are like that, the configuration space dimension just multiplied, so we get that property satisfying. But when you look in at Lucian's idea, it's very natural in the convex structure approach that you know, you look at mixed states from the beginning and say, well, to identify a particular mixed state, I need to measure a certain number of parameters, have a certain number of parameters. That's not natural in our formalism. For example, the configuration space formalism for a fixed P and S corresponds to a pure state wave function. We then have to sort of write in mixtures by hand to describe mixtures. They look nice for the particular case of the quantum case, but not more generally. So a convex structure is not so natural. You can handle it, but it doesn't look pretty. And so this is a less natural assumption. But I was thinking, yeah, well, maybe what we do have in our case, what we get for free, is canonical transformations. And one has to identify or specify what those canonical transformations are, the physical ones. And then if you specify them in a certain way, you'll come up with quantum mechanics. And so you could instead, quantum mechanics, so Lucian says, well, I want K, essentially it's the number of free parameters in my density matrix, or in a Hermitian operator. Well, canonical transformations in quantum mechanics are generated by a Hermitian operator too. So, you know, the set of unitary operators, I can, that's the same sort of K, essentially, that I'm looking at. And so I can just say, how many parameters do I need to specify an arbitrary canonical transformation, and perhaps make contact with your approach that way. Another interesting thing, when I looked at some of the talks that have been given, approaches based on conditional probabilities. And one can certainly, I don't know if I want to go through it all, but basically you can say, I'm going to start off in a given configuration space and with probability 1 of a particular result. Particular result K, maybe because I found it by measurement. I'm then going to do a measurement by transforming to another, but doing a canonical transformation and measuring in the fiducial basis or whatever. I'm going to do another measurement and calculate this. Well, you can work out the new probability distribution evolving from that eigenstate, if you like, because it's just you apply the canonical transformation, work it out. So if you place conditions on your conditional probability in our approach, you're essentially placing conditions on the possible generators of emotion again. And so that might be related to Fievel's and Gertz's work. So they're just some vague ideas there. Alrighty. So, sort of come to an end. We can get the Schrodinger equation. We can move from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics using uncertainty as our primary core concept, exact uncertainty. That's somewhat interesting, if not a full reconstruction. This ensemble is what's really interesting, I think, because they're two pretty simple ideas, the probability density on configuration space and an action principle. They're strong ideas, but you know, that's what allows us to do things like quantum classical things or go into gravity. It's very hands, gives you some very hands-on tools to use. You focus on probabilities. You've got the S, so you've got to take that into account when you do your transformations. But it means that you don't end up making categories by thinking, oh, psi has to do such and such. I think a number of the no-go theorems about how you can modify quantum mechanics to be non-linear, their problem was they're thinking in quantum mechanical terms because they're using psi and psi star as their coordinates. It's much better to think about P and S, really, I think. Yet we can consistently describe classical quantum interactions, and we can either get local nonlinear modifications or we can get a reconstruction of two qubit systems, but just based on locality in our formalism. We don't know which is the case. All right, so thank you very much.
I'm not really seeing, possibly my fault, seeing what the fundamental picture is supposed to be here.
Yep.
At the beginning, I thought you were saying that we were talking about position, actual positions in the momentum of real things. And then in the interlink, the fixed infinity configuration space configuration of measurement outcomes.
Ah, yes.
And of course, it makes kind of difference which of those ways to say how we can understand what this.
Yes, that's true.
So which is it? And if it's just measurement outcomes, then how would you understand the process of measurement that gives rise to those measurement outcomes?
Okay. There's two ways. Yeah, I think the confusion arose because I was giving a sort of historical development of of our own thoughts. It's sort of changed a bit. If I fix a configuration space, it's going to correspond to a set of measurement outcomes. Say the possibility of measuring spin up or down in a given direction, in the Z direction. In quantum mechanics, I guess you could imagine I can measure spin in any other direction by first rotating the system and then making a measurement in the Z direction, but what it actually gives me is the statistics for measurement in, say, the X direction or the Y direction. So I guess I'm trying to explain how you can go from one configuration space to another in another way. When you apply that canonical transformation, it transforms the probabilities, and so you can work out what the probabilities are of that new measurement where you do the rotation and then the z-direction measurement. That's one way of interpreting it. Or you can take a more passive thing where the system stays the same and you rotate the measurement apparatus and end up measuring in another direction. There's sort of Heisenberg and Schrodinger picture, which I guess I haven't fully sorted out in my own mind. Is that?
The question wasn't how we transition measurements relate to one another, but how the physical content of the world is supposed to give rise to the measurement outcome. But if, from your point of view, it looks like a quite standoffish, the theory is quite standoffish about what's in the world.
True.
Telling us about what's in the world, telling us about measurement outcomes.
True. Yeah, yeah.
And if his passed away making that feel uncomfortable, what's the point of talking about classical quantum interactions? If you've actually already got classical stuff going on, the measurement outcomes are in the classical facts. You don't need to say how does the quantum system interact with the classical system in order to give us the results measurements. You've got the measurements built in, classical measurements outcomes built in.
Yes. I think whenever you've got probabilities, you've got the idea that there's a pre-existing set of possible outcomes. I think everyone's, so a theory, a statistical theory is going to make a prediction about those, you know, a distribution over the outcomes.
But the outcome could be that thing that I have to say, or that the results, if it's something to a black box measuring device, will give me a light fashion or light.
Sure, sure, you can label them however you like, yes.
I mean, do you want to say that the measurement outcomes correspond to actually the actual way the world is, or do you want the instrumentalist about it to say, maybe I just, I do some experiment and I get
yeah, I guess I mean, sort of as general as possible, I don't want to try and be restricted in a particular approach. Whatever works consistently, I'm happy with. I don't know if Marcel's got a viewpoint on that. No. Yeah.
Okay, think
of that
probability distribution about the position.
Ah, yes. Yes.
And
the
Nabla
S,
you treat it as a
momentum
field.
It's essentially, yeah, like a momentum potential. You could interpret that way. What I prefer to do in the general formalism is just say, we want an action principle describing the evolution of P, so there has to be some quantity conjugate to P. I don't need to give it any further interpretation, but in classical mechanics you can give it a very specific interpretation that, yeah, its gradient for a continuous space is, can be interpreted as momentum, and you can have trajectories described by.
How would you introduce momentum?
How would I introduce what?
Sorry.
Oh, as a generator of translation. So something. So you perform a canonical transformation that translates your system and make a measurement. Oh no, it'd have to be the other way around. You'd have to use the capital X I define. So you can define a generator capital X, the ensemble momentum. If you apply that to your system, it turns out you get something shifts in your in the relevant probability distribution. It turns out to be the average value of the ensemble momentum. That's what you just identify momentum with what generates translations as a thing that's conjugate to the ensemble position.
And the formula is meant to be used also with many parts.
Yes. Oh, yes.
So it's basically non-local.
No. I see what you mean. So you're talking about the derivative with the fluctuations and so on. That's only if you try and assume f is some known sort of function. Here I just use it as a mechanism to generate an additional kinetic energy. So there's a fluctuation. You could have a realist theory for that fluctuation, and then yes, you would have a non-local theory. But I don't have any theory for that fluctuation. I guess the way I like to view it, and I don't know whether it's philosophically sound, is it just takes you away from having trajectories. Suddenly, grad S isn't some sort of real momentum in itself. Can't be for quantum mechanics, well, unless you take the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, yeah, which is non-local.
So this is related to what Chris was saying. It looks like if it is problem, it could then present a sort of a picture, ontological picture of what's going on. And you don't want to do it.
I could, yeah, there's two distinctions. For the general formalism, I don't think there's any ontological picture at all because there's no fluctuations that we're talking about. In the first part of the talk, I was just saying we start with classical concepts and move to the quantum equation by adding a non-classical concept, which is the fluctuation. And you could give an ontology for those fluctuations. You can write down non-local models for them. I don't like non-locality, so I don't want to write one down. But if you're doing a general reconstruction, you're not going to get to quantum mechanics the way we did by starting with classical. You know, quantum mechanics is independent of whether classical mechanics exists or not, I think. So, or it could be. So I don't want, you wouldn't, in the general idea of the formalism where there's just quantities P and S, two conjugate quantities, there doesn't have to be anything real underpinning those. What generates those probabilities in the sense of J is somehow real or X is somehow real, they're just labels for the possible measurement outcomes. I mean, I think it's a very interesting assumption that's made in all statistical theories is we somehow know what the possible outcomes of the measurement are before we've made them. That seems an amazing thing. How can we know that about the future? I guess it's something like Hume, which, well, it's happened before. We know we only get two results or maybe a null. Or maybe we just always throw away the result if it's something we didn't expect. But that, to me, that's quite a remarkable thing, that we somehow say, I know that I'm going to have one event outcomes before I even do the experiment. Well, how the hell did I know that? Yes. Schrodinger's theory. Ah, yes. Yes.
And you just three constraints.
Yes.
You said that gives you a leading model
of what you want. Yep, you've got to make another assumption. And in our original paper, we misunderstood what we thought by causality. We just thought we wouldn't want it to depend on higher derivatives of P, for example, because then we'd have to be able to not only specify P initially, we'd have to specify its gradient initially. And we thought, that's weird, that doesn't seem causal. But we were wrong. Of course, it's perfectly causal to have equations that do it. So you need some other assumption. There's interesting possible assumptions. One that could work. Let me see. One might be the fact that the covariance matrix essentially of those fluctuations has to be positive. And it may turn out that assumption itself, this is an idea I've had in the back of my head but never tested, may be actually strong enough to rule out any higher order terms. So that'd be one interesting thing where it's sort of, it is built in. The covariance matrix has to be positive, so you might be able to get rid of the terms automatically. But otherwise, yes, strictly speaking, you need another assumption. Otherwise, you don't get the Schrodinger equation. You've got the possibility of these higher order derivative terms. So at the moment, I guess we could say we're making a simplicity assumption, just taking up the first order derivatives in
P. What
They look like the only sort of terms you seem to get relate to derivatives of log P, because log P, once you've got factorizability, gives you log P1 plus log P2, and that's important for having your fluctuations being uncorrelated and your energies adding independently, the fluctuations adding independently for the different systems. So I don't think it's probably too hard to try and figure out. So I'm pretty sure that's the form of them. It's some years since I've played around with that. It would be interesting whether one can get rid of them by sleight of hand or just say, well, I've only got terms up to first order in S. I'm going to restrict the terms to first order in P. Or to say, well, I can get something a bit more general in quantum mechanics. So you put in the higher order terms and suddenly you find, I get a non-local equation and rule it out on grounds of non-locality. That might be another way to go. So I guess there's possibilities. Part of the problem, I guess I should be able to answer a question like that. Marcel and I each do this. We do this sort of work in our spare time every few years. We start emailing and working on something. So then we just stop. We've got to do something else. So we have limited time, unfortunately. But yeah, that's an interesting. It would be quite interesting. Another thing I can mention is, well, we didn't motivate the form of the classical starting Hamiltonian, the Brad S squared. Over 2m, and the vx, let's not worry about the vx for now. If I ask for a representation of the Galilean group, using these things. I know what the momentum looks like, the position, the angular momentum. I only need to find my H. So I can look, what is the form of the possible Hamiltonians I can take that will be consistent, give me a representation of the Galilean group in this Poisson bracket algebra. And it turns out there has to be a term grad S squared on 2m, T grad S squared on 2m. There's the classical term coming from the, and plus the possibility of higher order is it. It turns out you can add any term that's rotationally invariant, like the quantum term that we also add on, Fisher information term, and you'll get a representation of the Galilean group. So that'd be another interesting thing to look at, group representations, and restrict your Hamiltonians that way. Try and do the Poincaré group. That's a reason that I think doing nonlinear things would be interesting. There's no consistent quantum equation of a relativistic particle. You know, Dirac equation, Klein-Gordon equation, have got problems when you try and interpret them for a single particle. You have to interpret them as fields. So it would be interesting to have a nonlinear Schrödinger equation that gave you a represent, it was part of a representation of a Poincaré group or the Lorentz group. But that looks like a hard problem. And certainly just simply adding fluctuations doesn't seem to work there. And that's something I'd love to do some work on too.
Yeah. In connection with your two rodents,
yep.
You said that the question of locality is tricky, right?
Yeah, because you've got to think about what do we mean by locality, right?
Can you say a little bit more about I think if you didn't want to just say, make an estimate here, do a Bayesian updating and see.
Yeah, well, we certainly assume you do a Bayesian updating, you know, the measurement result, if you know the measurement result here, that we know what the correlated probability distribution should be here, and want that to hold. There's two problems. One is, how should we update S though? Should we leave it, say, unchanged? And if we do, we find that we get all row bits of qubits. And so we need to modify S in some way if we're to get nonlinearity. The other problem is just mathematical. The condition for no singling is if it collapses to up, then this it really tells you your generators should be able to be numerically equal to, because if you assume, also we've assumed in our work today that those generators L and M for the two rotations are also expectation values. And so we're just putting in that assumption. We may have to take out that. That's another degree of freedom we've got, take that assumption away. So we're doing that. So then it means that the numeric values of the generators, since they're expectation values, they can't change when we're doing something over here. And so with collapse, you get collapse to up or down, two probabilities worked out using Bayesian means. And this numerical value has to be the sum of the weighted probabilities of the two measurement sub-ensembles that you get. And it just turns out that's a nasty functional equation. We've reduced our eight-dimensional phase space to six dimensions. But because we don't know what happens to S, it's quite an open, messy equation. And so finding the solutions, or knowing whether there are solutions, we haven't nailed down yet. I'm a bit pessimistic. I think it's turning out we've got so close. We've got, for example, nonlinear, a bit like Ariel had yesterday. But we can get nonlinear equations, but then we can do a canonical transformation, not a unitary transformation, and bring it back to, you know, equivalent predictions on the probabilities, even though the F has changed. So yeah, it's just a bit subtle. We're feeling our way. We're not theory experts in group theory either. It probably doesn't help. Yeah.
Just to remind, another problem that might arise is nonlinear equation from the relation of the second problem. Is that the Paul Weinberg?
Oh, yeah.
The solution was shown by
Shimony, was it? Oh, Perez.
It's not that every nonlinear equation has this problem.
Yeah.
And the conditions that you assume that Paul Weinberg should use this.
Yeah, I read the paper, but yeah, I don't think I've applied it to thinking about this problem, so yeah, I should do that and just see whether there's a no-go theorem there. I think he assumed something linear about mixtures, but I can't remember what it is. Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you.
Any question? At one point you said that the fundamental thing is going to be the key distribution.
Yep.
And so their evolution should be governed by an action principle.
Yep.
Is that still obvious stuff?
I agree, but you can't even quantize a classical system without an action principle, a continuous one. But it's our fundamental object. Well, again, it connects with Ariel's work. You know, in the configuration space was a space of probability distributions, and it's the same here. You're quite right. In any approach for thinking about physical theory, interpretation's only as strong as weak as the strongest assumption. And yeah, that assumption gives you a lot of structure. Not as much as a C-star algebra, so, you know, that's good. But I agree. It gives you more structure than is necessary. It's just, so I guess it's partly, there's good historical support for saying fundamental objects obey an action principle. But yeah, choose your fundamental object and do it. So yeah, that's quite true. So really, you can only justify an approach by its results. And here I think some of the interesting results are that we're able to do some detailed analysis and go beyond quantum mechanics, at least in hybrid interactions. Maybe do some other stuff as well. Yeah, but that's a good point. It seems innocuous at first. Oh, you evolve commercial vision, but it gives you the fuss on algebra structure, and that's a lot of machinery. A prediction. You have to choose your set of generators to say, you know, all the ways in which all the degrees of freedom of a single particle, essentially what the different observables are. Because I'd say you can think of, say, you pick an initial configuration space, up, down, or whatever. If you're just measuring that basis, you can think of doing a canonical transformation and then measuring. So once you've got the set of canonical transformations, you get the set of possible measurement distributions you can get, each one corresponding to a different observable, because you've done something different to the system each time. It works for classical particles, yeah, that's true. It's interesting in quantum mechanics, because the ensemble Hamiltonian has the grad P over P, delta functions are a problem. There's no point starting with in a Hilbert space. You can't take that as a consistent initial starting point. But with classical particles, you can. So in that pointer, for example, I assume there's an initial probability distribution. I could assume it was a delta function. No infinities arise. The pointer will go from a definite starting position to a definite, when you make a measurement, one of two definite starting positions, because you couple fluctuations in from the classical system. Yeah. Yeah, so that is an interesting point. Coffee might be out there now.